All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Yeah, baby. It's the lightning round.
This is strikes twice. Answers.
What's that?
It strikes twice, apparently.
Yeah. Take it easy. This is the show that lasts 1 hour, and Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 Pacific, we have the loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. That's when Scott is more chatty, more expansive. And before we get to the questions, Scott, I think, wants to clear up a couple of things from a previous episode. Is that what my sources are telling me?
You have good sources. You could be an intelligence officer.
It's an open source operation here. Just rely on those open sources, and you can't.
As well, opposed to
open source.
Jeff, I'm trying to speak.
I'm sorry.
Last week on Judge Napolitano, in the Marine Corps, when I was intelligence officer, they issued me a staff sergeant and a corporal. And there's a reason why they do that to young intelligence officers, because we make mistakes all the time. Normally, we pre-brief them. And I was getting ready to go on the judge's show, and I knew we were going to be talking about Carcassonne. So I went ahead and got read up on things. And one of the articles I read said that the left bank was lower than the right bank. And I went, okay. And I'm looking at the map. North here, south here, and the river. And I go, left bank, right bank. Yeah, I'll keep that in the back of my mind. So I'm talking to the judge later on. I said, and you know, the Russians are pulling back to the right bank, and they're going to be up there on the high ground, and their artillery is going to be able to reach further and all that. I sounded really smart. And then everybody hit me with, no. The Russians are pulling over to the left bank, and it's lower than the right bank where the Ukrainians are. And I went, well, how can that be? I read the article. And they said, no. See, my sergeant would have said, hey, Lieutenant, when you look at a river, it's based upon the direction of the flow. So you orient the map based upon direction of the flow, left bank, right bank, flow. I got it mixed up. So all those people who are very upset with me, I apologize. Jeff hasn't issued me a Lance Corporal or Corporal or Sergeant. And they let the Lieutenant go, and the Lieutenant got ahead of himself. So We got the banks right. The next thing was I just want to clarify some things about me being a Russian sympathizer. I think we had that conversation too. First of all, you've seen that movie My Cousin Vinny, where the kid confesses, or he's questioned by the sheriff, and he says, "You shot the clerk." I shot the clerk. But when he reads it back at trial, I shot the clerk, making it seem like it was a confession. And I think that we had a My Cousin Vinny thing where people might think that I was saying I'm a Russian sympathizer. Now we go to my next favorite movie, Jack Nicholson, Tom Cruise interrogating him. You want the truth? You can't handle the truth. Are you a Russian sympathizer? Goddamn right, I'm a Russian sympathizer. And I have to say I am right. Why? Not because I sympathize with Russia, but because Russia's on the right side of history on this one. We're going to talk about it today, about Nazis, Nazi sympathizers, etc. You can't be on the right side if you're supporting Nazis. Bottom line. And on this issue, Russia is just right. It's not that I'm always sympathetic to Russia. Not. But in this case, this particular time and place, Russia's on the right side of history. Russia's doing the right thing. And therefore, I sympathize with what Russia's doing. Take it as you wish. So read the transcript. I shot the clerk. I'm a Russian sympathizer. Yeah, I guess I did shoot the clerk. Okay, Jeff, over to you.
All right. Naughty boy, but we'll only give you a couple of cracks on that whip since you've acknowledged it. That's the best we can do when we make mistakes. Let's go to the questions from our beloved audience. Dory in Canada. Canada's Nazi-in-Chief Chrystia Freeland was parading around Toronto with UPA Bandera Nazi banners, chanting Nazi war slogans. Will Russia denazify NATO when Chrystia Freeland replaces Jens Stoltenberg? And before you answer that, let me just say that Dory has her finger on the pulse, because that happens to be the topic of Scott's latest Substack post, and you can read that at scottritterextra.com. And now back to the question.
Okay, well, Chrystia Freeland parading around Toronto with a Bandera Nazi banner. Yeah, the red and black banner is 100% a Bandera banner. People who say, no, red and black's been around Ukraine forever. Well, you know, so is red and white, the color of the Nazi flags. But it was put in a certain thing with a swastika in the middle. It's a Nazi flag. We know what it is. We know what that banner is, especially when it says Slava Ukraina. Then you flip it over and it's glory to the heroes. The Bandera movement made those two phrases. It's a greeting that the Bandera movement adopted in the 1940s as they were slaughtering Jews, Poles, and Russians by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. To pretend that Slava Ukraina, especially in the context of the red and black, is not a neo-Nazi war cry is to say that Sieg Heil just means to victory. And forget about Adolf Hitler. We all know when you say Sieg Heil, you're saying something that's affiliated with Adolf Hitler. And when you say Slava Ukraina and you get glory to the heroes returning back at you, we know what's going on. So she is a Nazi sympathizer 100%. She was raised as a Nazi sympathizer and she is acting as a Nazi sympathizer today. Will Russia denazify her? No. NATO is going to become increasingly irrelevant and Russia will just sit back and let NATO denazify itself.
All right. Let me just stop the 30-second clock. I think I'm getting the hang of this now. This is a question from last week. Scott said he would research it and then come back with an answer. And I have no idea whether or not that happened, but I assume he did it because our weapons inspector is diligent and he likes our audience. And if he says he's going to do something for them, he does it. Now, I've just set you up to look really bad if you didn't, but I have a feeling you did. The U.S. has occupied one of our islands since 1942 and doesn't want to give it back for, quote, national security reasons. Do you think it's because we are halfway to China or is something else in play? And will the island one day be returned?
Well, I actually did spend more than an hour trying to research this this question. You know, I went back to, you know, what islands the U.S. occupied during the Second World War, 1942. Bora Bora was one, but French Polynesia governs it. It's under French control. I can't find any other island that the U.S. controls to this date. But you know, if you can give me the name of the island, I will go from there. But I did my best. I was diligent. You know, so be it.
All right. I think that's we have to put the burden of proof on somebody who says they know of something. It's kind of impossible to prove something doesn't exist. It's a lot more possible to prove something does exist. So in the absence of such evidence, we must lean towards believing it's just not so. There is no island to give back. Jamtat from in front of my computer. Do you see any conflict between subjecting oneself to an NDA and being a supporter of free speech? Do you regret having signed any NDA? Would you recommend to anyone else to sign or not sign NDAs?
Well, an NDA is a non-disclosure agreement. And if you're going to be in the intelligence business, they're a part of your life, especially if you're read into various top secret, code word, compartmented programs. And I was read into a whole bunch of them. And you signed the non-disclosure agreement. Basically, it's a lifetime commitment not to discuss anything that you've learned in this special compartment in this classified program, and to submit everything that you write that could possibly deal with this to the U.S. government for pre-publication review. Do I regret signing? No, I was doing my job as a, I didn't join the military to write a book about top secret programs. I joined the military to serve my country. And I became an intelligence officer to serve my country in an intelligence capacity, which means I signed the NDA freely. But here's the thing, NDA and free speech. First of all, you don't have free speech doesn't allow you to break the law. Free speech, you know, yeah, I can't jump up in the middle of a theater and shout fire. It's against the law. And I can't give away the nation's secrets. So I am required, if I'm going to write about, sir, for, I'll give you an example. I'm writing a book right now about my wartime experience hunting Scuds. I signed a couple of NDAs. So this book will have to go to pre-publication review. Now we are, you know, 30 some odd years past, coming up on 30 years past the war. There's an automatic declassification procedure, I think, at the end of 25 years. Some things can continue to be classified, but they have to meet a certain exception. I'll submit, and if the government doesn't respond in a timely fashion, then I have fulfilled my duty to submit, and free speech allows me to move forward. So these are one of the great unchallenged things. Most people get in trouble when they fail to submit, but if you have submitted something for pre-publication review and the government doesn't respond in a timely fashion and your reasons for publication are common sense, meaning you're not deliberately trying to hurt the country, the government's going to have a hard time prosecuting under freedom of speech.
All right. Well, I think you thoroughly explain what your attitude is toward NDAs in general. But having said that, is there any particular NDA that afterwards you regretted signing?
None. Zero. Okay. They all rode me into classified programs. So I had to sign them to get in.
Well, I know you had to comply, but you could still kind of regret it. Boy, I wish I hadn't agreed to that.
No, because then I wouldn't have been able to do what I did.
All right. I won't push that anymore. Let's go to Germany and Thomas. How do you explain that Russia has failed to stop the flow of Western weapons into Ukraine? You can find their exact location in real time, even on Telegram channels, for crying out loud, says Thomas. Is it incompetence or something else?
Well, it's not incompetence. Hey, Thomas, I don't know what you do for a living, but I'll tell you what. Why don't you go ahead and lift up your hands, swear yourself in, become a targeting officer, go to Russia. What the hell, they're looking for people right now. Tell them you want to get involved in targeting. I'll bet you $1,000 you aren't going to be able to interdict anything. Why? It ain't as easy as you think. Want to know why I know? I used to be in charge of interdicting Scud missiles during the Gulf War. It's hard to do. It's a mobile target. It's a relocatable target. Real-time intelligence. Have you ever done targeting, Thomas? Hey, real-time. Got the target. They got the target. Spin up the jet. Put the bomb on. They got the target. Target ain't there anymore, Thomas. Why? It moved. It ain't as easy as you think it is. All right? So, A, the Russians are trying. B, they're in a political environment that says we don't want to start a war. So while it might be immediately discernible when it crosses the border, hell, we just saw two Russian missiles land in Poland. This is going to be a big stink. Poland's going to go, oh, my God, we were attacked, and all this stuff. It'll calm down. It'll go away. But my point is Russia doesn't want that. Russia doesn't need that. So Russia lets it come in a little bit, and then they take care of the targeting thing. But by that time, it gets a little hard because it's relocating, and the guys managing the relocation are pretty damn professional, like the CIA, like JSOC, that's Joint Special Operations Command. These guys are doing that. It's not as easy as you think. It's a tough thing to hit mobile, relocatable targets.
Well, clearly you don't agree with Thomas. In fact, I think it would be accurate to say you are doubting Thomas.
Whoa.
Get it? All right.
That's the only way you're going to get laughter, Jeff. Yes, laugh track.
Really?
Well, I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you.
Pavel from Russia, what do you think about prompt global strike and news that the U.S. could suddenly attack Russia? Does it mean Russia won't have enough time to respond if such an attack occurs? What would the consequences be?
Prompt global strike is something that's been around for a while, but it recently came into the current discussion because I think the Russian Defense Ministry or some think tank affiliated with it published a book or a paper on it that talked about the vulnerabilities of Russia's strategic nuclear arsenal to prompt global strike. Prompt global strike is basically taking missiles like the Trident, putting a conventional warhead on it, so you can get a non-nuclear precision strike that can take out a silo, take out mobile missiles. There's also loitering munitions that can come over, and hey, it's a whole program the United States is putting in. A, we don't know if it works. B, let's assume that it does work. Then we go to C, there's a thing called dead hand. D, you take out Russian command and control. E, dead hand fires. F, the world ends. And there's no way you change that equation. So prompt global strike is just a quick way for the United States to commit suicide and take the world with it. And American planners know it. It looks good on paper. In reality, one, we don't know if it works. Two, if it did work, it would just mean the United States would kill itself, because it's not going to take out the dead hand, and the dead hand is going to take out the world.
I thought that prompt global strike was more of a, it was more general than that. In other words, it's something that really couldn't even be judged, because they're trying, you know, they're exploring different types of ways to strike.
Well, it's a concept, but they actually do now have weapons that they can fill in the blanks.
Yeah. Okay. Lira, a Russian in Poland, and I had to edit this because it was a bit lengthy. I can tell you that Lira is not thrilled to be a Russian in Poland. Central Asia, Eastern Europe, was once infected by visceral anti-Semitism, and this ideology was defeated. Another disease, Russophobia, has taken its place. How do we cure the Poles and then Europe from that disease?
Well, first of all, I'm going to take umbrage at the your initial claim. If you think anti-Semitism has been defeated in Eastern Europe, go read some Telegram channels that come from Eastern Europe. The amount of hatred towards the Jews is just, it's overwhelming. So I think anti-Semitism was suppressed, but it's coming back. And one of the ways it's coming back is in Poland and in Ukraine, where there's just a huge amount of anti-Semitism from these ultra-nationalist groups that just don't like Jews, never have, never will. How do we deal with Russophobia? By Russia winning. I mean, it's an easy way to do it. Russia wins, and just let the Russian haters rot in their own little cesspool of, you know, ideologically challenged nonsense while they cower in their basements. I mean, ultimately, it's a generational thing when you're trying to reprogram a society. It's a generational thing. It's going to take 2-3 generations. Again, back to Chrystia Freeland. We just talked about her, this Canadian Nazi. Her grandfather was a Nazi, literally. He ran a newspaper in occupied Krakow that glorified the 1943 suppression of the Warsaw Ghetto and glorified the 14th SS Galicia Division of the Waffen-SS. He went to Canada. He raised a daughter who was a Nazi sympathizer, who raised a granddaughter, Chrystia Freeland, who's a Nazi sympathizer, who's raising two daughters right now who are Nazi sympathizers. How do you know they're Nazi sympathizers, Scott? How dare you? Because she sends them to the same scouting group that she went to, the Planck Group. Which is a Bandera Nazi organization that parades around wearing the color, a brown SS uniform, the red and black flag, Slava Ukraine, holding up a photograph of Bandera. You know, if a group in the United States, a youth group, was parading around with the swastika and holding up Adolf Hitler's picture, I would call them sort of a Hitler youth group. Imagine that, Hitler youth, nice term. The point is, it's generational. You have to cut this kind of thinking out, and then it's going to take even more generations to make sure that it's eliminated. But right now, the anti-Semitism and the neo-Nazi ideology, Russophobia, it exists in current generations, and it's going to be around for a long, it's going to be around for as long as all of us are alive. It's going to take many generations for that to go away. And that's only, look at the South. The South got beat in the Civil War, and we're still dealing with the consequences of that struggle today in America with the racism and the North-South animus, et cetera. Ooh, first time that happened.
That's the 32nd tone. No, you're in. You still have 30 seconds more. And as I mentioned earlier, Scott addresses that in more detail in his latest Substack post at scottritterextra.com. Ryan from Denver. Russia recently carried out an evacuation of civilians in Kherson. Now that they have pulled back from the city, does this give them more freedom to attack targets within it?
Well, never forget that Kherson is a Russian city. It may be occupied by Ukraine, but it's a Russian city and territory belonging to Russia. So the idea that Russia would want to level Kherson is absurd in the extreme. If the Ukrainians were digging in and firing towards Russia from positions in the city, then I think Russia would be able to respond. But What the Russians also did was knock off the power, knock off the water. And I think we're seeing that the Ukrainians now have to evacuate any civilians that remain because it's a city that nobody can live in and survive in. I think it's going to become a ghost city. And it'll be that way until Russia comes swinging in from the other direction when the 200,000 troops are going to arrive on the scene next month, arrive, and Russia goes on a counteroffensive that's going to take care of the Ukrainian military problem in the area of Kherson and elsewhere once and for all.
Okay, and nice to see that comment from Russia thanking us for streaming at this hour. It's much more convenient for them. They can watch it live at what's a normal hour for them. Also, I see a couple of comments about what I'm drinking. Yes, it's water. We started the stream at 11:30 in the morning, my time. And somebody keeps recommending Portuguese wine. Well, how about a specific recommendation? It can't be that every single wine made in Portugal is a great wine. Give me something specific, baby, and not too expensive either. I like bargains. Ryan from Denver, we already heard from him. Let's move on to the next one. Hold on, I'll get it. When discussing the art of war for the activist last Friday, you forgot my original question. Smiley face, as to indicate not being too critical, so don't yell at me. I'm interpreting the punctuation. Here it is. What book, aside from Sun Tzu, The Art of War, do you recommend for aspiring analysts to read for practical guidance? Well, I kind of thought that question was answered when we talked about this book. I think he was recommending his own book, Waging Peace, which is going to be republished by us as The Art of War for the Activist.
But I think he's talking about an analyst, which is a different question, because The Art of War isn't about analysis per se. It's guidelines for leadership and command thinking. Jeff, what we need to do is put an asterisk. I don't know if I said that correctly, but we put one of those little starry things on that question. And what I'm going to do is actually go in and find a reading list for the aspiring analyst, because that would directly answer the question that he asked. And we'll do it that way.
All right. Asterisk. I think halfway through the word, you remembered there's an S before the K at the end, and you got it in just in time.
Did I get it in just in time? Okay.
I think that's exactly
I was going the wrong direction.
All right, next question. Let me stop the clock so we can start it again for this one. The catcher from, no, nope. I'll be all right.
Hey, so Jeff, I just want to point out that you have the Azov flag colors, and I'm not happy about that. Black, red over black.
It's always something. It's always something.
Nazi.
And by the way, when I sit down at the Thanksgiving table, I may not always have the proper memories of the American Indians in mind either. Sometimes things just sort of change as you go on and have different meanings.
All right. Talk to me before dinner. I'll fix it.
Okay. Pass the cranberry sauce. Keith from Hudson Valley, New York. Would you ever consider recording an audio version of your new book? I know many folks with disabilities, including those with visual impairments, that use primarily audio to read, learn, and communicate.
There is going to be an audio edition of this book. It's in production right now. I did volunteer to bring my voice to the project. I thought they would want the book written by the person to be spoken by the person. But the people who make audiobooks decided that my speaking voice was inadequate to the task, and they're getting somebody who is apparently better at the job. And since I'm in the business of getting this book out as quick as possible to as many people as possible in as short a time as possible, rather than fight that, since we had somebody who was going to go through and make the audiobook, I allowed the book to be spoken in somebody else's voice. But yes, there will be an audiobook very soon.
Wow. I'm willing to consider the possibility that, since I'm not an expert in that field, that might be a wise decision. However, I must say, as a layman and a big fan of yours, that sounds like an insane decision, because you are a world-class speaker. That's the reason you have this huge audience and people keep coming back, because people love your passion and they love how articulate you are. It's the very thing that makes you a star. And they're saying,
I think so. I mean, I think they needed to hear in my voice the passage from the book where I say, well, I can't say the word because it's a Russian curse word, but
it's okay. This is the internet. Anything goes.
Where's Zayabis? They need to hear that from me because it basically, I told a Russian general to F off.
Oh,
I didn't mean to. I thought it meant work together. A strong word.
Oh, you said by mistake. Okay.
Somebody told me it meant something, so I gave a toast in a very high level function. They all went, what the?
That's hilarious. You thought you were toasting the guy, and you're really telling him to fuck off?
Yeah.
That's great.
He laughed. Fortunately, he laughed, so it saved my career.
So he knew you were doing it by mistake, or
he knew exactly. I got to read the book, Jeff. Really, I sent you a copy. You should read
it. Yeah, I know. I'm a slow reader. That's as funny as the Roberto Benigni movie where he's doing the fake translations. That's on Tori's list. I think. What was the movie you mentioned at the beginning? Oh yeah, My Cousin Vinny. That's Tori, so we're gradually exposing Tori to all the classics, the contemporary classics. There's Maverick.
He was chewing my show. I had to get him.
It's always good to say hi to Maverick.
Okay.
Jersey in Poland. Why didn't the Russians blow up all 26 bridges on the Dnieper River? And why didn't they carry out a single act of sabotage on the Ukrainian territory to cut NATO weapons supplies?
Well, Jersey, call up the Ukrainian general staff and ask him what percentage of the weapons shipped from Poland to Ukraine get to the front lines. I'm going to bet you every penny I have that the answer isn't 100%. Fact is, I'll bet you that the answer probably isn't 80%. I would even guess that the answer isn't 70%. Now, I can't go much below because I'm getting in the area I don't know, but I will tell you that the Russians are targeting this stuff. They are hitting it. Warehouses are blowing up, and a lot of equipment is being destroyed. Now, when you say active sabotage, as somebody who used to do special reconnaissance for a living and even planned a few of these missions during the Gulf War, people who execute them properly don't talk about them. In fact, it's one of the problems I'm having with the current book that I'm writing is to talk about a certain U.S. Army Special Operations Force that allegedly operated deep inside Western Iraq looking for Scud missiles over 30 years ago. They still don't want to talk about it because it gives away sensitive operational. So the Russians are out there doing stuff. Are they going to brag about it? Do they really have to publicize it so you and me and everybody can go, wow, the Russians are really doing something. We're onto it. No, they're just going to shut up and do it. They're going to do it. Now, why didn't they blow up all the bridges? Ask the damn Russian generals. I'm fairly certain that they'll blow up the bridges they need to blow up, and they won't blow up the bridges they don't want to blow up. Maybe they're looking at the possibility of carrying out offensive operations in the near future where those bridges would be to their benefit. Maybe they're luring the Ukrainians into a kill zone by saying, here's a bridge, use it. I don't know. I don't have access to their plans. I'm a Russian sympathizer, apparently, but not a good enough one that they call me up and tell me exactly what their war plans are going to be. But let's stop denigrating the Russians. Let me make the following two points. Russia just blew the snot out of Ukraine today. I think they're proven that they can do things pretty well. Two, they got 200,000 troops, 10 to 15 divisions worth of men coming in next month. What does Poland and NATO and Ukraine have to step up against that? Nothing. So we can sit here and poke the Russians here, there, and everything, as all armchair generals do. I think this war is heading in a direction that Russia is very comfortable with.
All right, just in the 3-minute limit. Very good. You are a pro. Shane Gillis from New York is quickly becoming a fan of yours. Hey, you got a fan, Scott. The way you handled questions surrounding your legal issues in the last podcast was very open and upfront. What books influenced you and helped shape you into the person I admire today?
Well, I'm going to answer this. I think books about integrity is important. Look, some of the first books I remember reading were the Louis L'Amour books and about the Sacketts. about the Sackett family. And if you read about the Sackett family, Tyler Sackett, and I forget the other T, there's a couple of Sackett brothers out there, but they were always doing the right thing. They're on the right side of the law. They were working to do. And so, you know, you're reading a Western, you're not only getting the whole thing about the Westerns, but you're learning about integrity, doing the right thing, honesty, et cetera, the value of a handshake, et cetera. So, you know, when I'm in, you know, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, those are the books I was reading. And then I graduated to, I think one of the most fundamental books was Once an Eagle, about two U.S. Army officers and their advancement from World War One or pre-World War One all the way up to Vietnam. And again, it's a book about integrity, about, you know, making the hard decisions and stuff. And then Trinity by Leon Uris was another book that was just a big one about the kind of decisions a man has to make in life and the consequences attached to those decisions and stuff like that. But those three books, Armageddon by Leon Uris, another one, sticks with me forever again for the same thing, that there's a price to be paid for doing the right thing. And sometimes that price is your life.
All right. Shane Gillis is a comedian's name, somebody says. Okay. It sounds like a comedian's name, or there is a comedian named Shane Gillis. Let's get an answer on that if you can, Tori. Dying to know. George from Albania. Is Albania being used for a proxy war by NATO against Iran as a base for the MEK? Is there a risk that Iran will attack Albania under the pretext that Albania has become the base of subversive military operations aimed at overthrowing the regime?
The MEK is Mujahideen al-Khalq. It's a Marxist cult-like organization that's been around in Iran since the 1970s, I'm going to venture to say. They've been heavily against the theocracy, and they're in a life-and-death struggle. The MEK used to have bases in Iraq, and indeed they fought as part of the Iraqi army during the Iran-Iraq war, and even as a weapons inspector. There were numerous MEK facilities that, in fact, we inspected a couple of them because we didn't know what the hell they were. We're looking at them on a map going, what is this place? So we went and inspected it. And, you know, it is what it is. Are they a proxy for NATO? I don't know. I mean, their involvement in Iran predates, NATO's not at war with Iran. I think the MEK is what it is. The fact that they're based out of Albania does create problems for the Iranians, but the Iranians aren't going to attack Albania. I mean, first of all, having the MEK in Albania creates quite a distance between their base and Iran. And the Iranians, you know, have a strong presence in neighboring Bosnia. And in Bosnia, there's a lot of Muslims, the Iranians helped them out. And I think the Iranians continue to have a presence there. So I think the Iranians are comfortable with their ability to collect intelligence on the MEK in Albania. I don't think there's going to be a war between Albania and Iran in Europe over the MEK. I think Iran's pretty good at killing the MEK inside Iran and tracking them from Albania, and et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Jim Hyonis from Havertown, Pennsylvania. That's the state that just elected a stroke victim and, in a separate election, a dead guy. Interesting judgment they have there. You've identified the role and efficacy of artillery in Russian military doctrine, but Russian air power hasn't received much elaboration. Have Ukrainian air defense capabilities discouraged the full implementation of Russian air power?
You know, one of the things that happens is in the West, we tend to mirror image the way we fight war onto others, and then we make judgments accordingly. We use close air support in a way to do things that Russia accomplishes with their artillery. So a lot of times when we take a look at what Russia is doing on the battlefield, you know, if we were doing it, we'd have close air support coming in. So right off the bat, we see the lack of Russian air power in relevance to what we imagine should be done. And we say, ah, there's some reason for that. And the first reason is just doctrinally. The Russians don't do close air support like we do close air support. Even when they bring in their planes, if you take a look at their Su-25s and their helicopters, they use an onboard fire computer that has the plane. You know, we'll come in. I used to do this. We'll come in, pop up, come down, strike, pull out, go. They come in, pop up, fire their missiles, and go back down and go out low. And then the missiles are like artillery coming in on the target. They use an onboard fire control computer. And most Americans look at that and go, what the hell was that? Why would you do that? That's so inefficient. Well, because they're not getting close to the target so they can evade the air defense. And believe it or not, that it's pretty accurate. You take a look where the missiles are hitting, they're landing right on the target they need to land on. So it's just a different way of doing it. First of all, the Ukrainians do have extensive air defense, and it's still shooting down Russian airplanes, shooting down Russian helicopters on occasion. So they have to take it seriously. But I think it's just a combination of doctrine and a reticence on the part of Russia to get airplanes shot down. I don't think that they're willing to risk aircraft at this juncture to do things that can be accomplished by artillery. We did see today that they are bringing in their strategic air capabilities. They brought in their Tu-95 Bear bombers, and they released a whole bunch of cruise missiles at Ukraine. And if the air war develops further, I think you'll see, for instance, if NATO challenged Russia in the airspace over Ukraine, I think you'd see more air combat. But I think the Russians, we tend to make judgments based upon what we think they should be doing, as opposed to understanding why they do what they do.
Okay. We have a commenter, Klaus, weighed in and saying it makes sense to vote for dead politicians because dead politicians are the only ones who don't lie.
Hoo-ah!
Also, I looked it up, and Shane Gillis is a comedian. I don't know if you see, that's him. He's been on the Joe Rogan podcast before.
Well, Shane, if that was you, get me on the Joe Rogan podcast.
Wow. So Scott celebrity admirers is
well, we don't know that.
The list, is growing.
Probably not.
Hold on. Scott had a discussion with Roger Waters last week, the legendary rock star, and Roger said a few things that indicated he follows you quite regularly. Scott, he's really up on things, and he's a big
admirer. He read the book.
Yeah. Well, he's a quicker reader than I am. No, that was really cool. We should link to that.
Yeah, I was starstruck, literally. I was like, Roger Waters, oh my God.
Well, it didn't show. It didn't show. You were your usual loquacious self, and he seemed quite engaged.
Loquaciousness shown through.
And Randy Credico made that happen. He did a good job of just kind of letting you two go at it, and that's how I would have handled it. I would have stepped back and, of course, pleased our audience. Especially the ones who say I interrupt too much, would not have interrupted then. Greg S. from Austin, Texas. Keep Austin weird. Well, we got to get back to Austin, huh?
Yeah,
remember those days? That was a great time.
I like Austin.
Yeah. As you gain a bigger voice, you may become a bigger threat to the power structure. Other than censorship, do you believe the power structure will take additional action against you? And what do you do to protect yourself?
Well, the first thing is don't give them an opportunity. And we don't need to dig into it, but while I'm 100% convinced I've never committed a crime, perception creates its own reality and you just avoid. So, live a clean life. And they will have a hard time putting their hooks into you. And then the other thing is the danger. I mean, for instance, if I don't want a speeding ticket, don't speed.
That's it.
I live my life. I don't keep a low profile, but they won't get any traction on me. There's no traction to be gotten on Scott Ritter. The big fear is the political violence that exists in this country. And the fact that my government has worked with the Ukrainian government to put a big damn target on my back, to call me an information terrorist with an emphasis on terrorist, with the notion that the world would be better off if I were dead. And the fact that 60 miles down the road in Ellaville, New York, we have one of those neo-Nazi children, Hitler youth indoctrination camps, where maybe some of their graduates might say, hey, we've got tar guys back. U.S. government's paying for it. Let's go kill them. That's what worries me. And again, not because of me, but because they may hurt my family. They may hurt my dogs. They want to hurt me, hurt me. I don't give a rat's ass. Do it right the first time, guys, because I tell you what, I may be 61, but I have enough reaction in me that if you don't take me down, if you don't hit a big bone or an organ, I'm coming for you and I'll take you out. That's a straight up challenge. I'm not backing away from these guys. I mean, screw them. Screw them. You know what? You're trying to intimidate me and my country. The first goddamn amendment of the Constitution that I took an oath to uphold and defend with my life. I mean, if I'm willing to die for the Constitution, that means I'm willing to die in defense of the First Amendment. So you think this is a freaking game? It ain't a game. It's real. I just wish it wasn't, you know, it didn't have to go this way. Free speech should never be about, you know, paying that heavy of a price for it. But if you quit, if you retreat, if you draw back, then they win. So all you Ellenville Nazis, fuck off.
Hoo-ah!
All right. You tell them, baby. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and El Grande Lebowski. Speaking of films that Tori should see, do you know what that's a reference to, Tori, El Grande Lebowski?
Is it The Big Lebowski? I actually haven't seen that movie, but with the word Lebowski, it was a pretty good guess.
Scott, tell her, am I right? She's got to see that movie. That's a classic.
This aggression will not stand.
I'm the dude.
I have a list going. So
that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
The dude abides.
The dude abides.
I like your style, dude.
That's a great cameo appearance, too.
When put it on the list, Tori, and also don't forget Scent of a Woman.
Yeah.
Hoo-ha!
Flamethrower to this place.
We're just going to keep doing those lines until you watch the movie. When should Russia consider taking out Ukraine's command and control? I understand they would rather keep Zelensky alive, but at the same time, wouldn't it send a message to the West that they have lost?
Well, rumor has it, and I have to emphasize the rumor, that the some of the missiles that hit Kiev today might have hit the Ministry of Defense or the Ukrainian General Staff. So we'll see. Look, Zelensky is becoming an absolute detriment. He's a negative asset for not only Ukraine, but for the West. He's not well-liked at all. I mean, if you watched him speak at the G20, you know, he went well over his allotted time and they had to pull him off, and nobody likes what he's saying. Nobody likes him. He's not a nice guy. And he's a spoiled child. You know, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more. You know, we gave you everything. Give me more. And that message is getting old. The danger is if you remove him, you may actually have some competent leadership step in. And I mean, one of the things, you know, the worries is that the Ukrainian chief of staff begins with a Z too, but I'm going to mispronounce it and everybody get mad at me, so I'm not going to say it. But you know, he could step in, and you know, if you take a look at like recent New Yorker articles, I wrote an article about that. Article by a gentleman named Yaffa that basically rose the profile of the military and sort of put Zelensky over here. I think the Russians want to keep Zelensky in as long as possible because the man is just a useless force. He's a negative. He's a black hole of competency. Everything around him, all competency sucks in and disappears. It's just a sea of incompetency. And that plays to Russia's benefit. The last thing they want is effective, efficient Ukrainian leadership. And I think what they're trying to do is create the condition where the military moves in on its own volition and removes him from power. And it would only do so if it felt that it could negotiate a better deal, because the military knows the truth. They ain't going to win this war. They're going to lose, and they're going to lose big. But they're not the ones calling the shot.
Next question is from Filip Markovic from Zemun City, Serbia. What do you think about aircraft carriers in modern warfare in a fight against an army with strong missile weapons? Are they just like sitting ducks, or do they still have a purpose?
Well, in a major war, aircraft carriers are giant graveyards. I mean, they're going to be hit, they're going to be sunk, and that's it. Modern missiles are too much for the air defense systems on the carrier or the carrier battle group. They'll either evade them or they'll saturate them. Bottom line is the carrier is going down. It has zero chance of surviving a concerted attack by an enemy equipped with modern precision-guided missiles, especially hypersonic missiles. In any other war besides that, I mean, the carrier gives you certain power projection capabilities. So I wouldn't get rid of the carrier per se. It's an important force and as an expeditionary force, but it's going to serve virtually no viable. It has no viable role in a major conflict with China. China will sink them in a heartbeat. So, and then what? Russia? You can bring them up the Pacific. Russia will sink them in a heartbeat. So I think America puts far too much money into the aircraft carrier. It's a legacy system. The Navy loves it. Their entire promotion cycle is geared towards, you know, carrier battle groups. But if you're talking about fighting and winning the next war, it's time to de-emphasize the aircraft carrier and come up with a new way of doing business.
Okay. And hold on. Did we ask that one already?
We didn't ask this one.
Okay, I think I might have screwed up who asked the question because I see the same name. Filip Markovic from Zemun City. I'm not sure if that's correct. But anyway, somebody's asking if military aid Ukraine is drying up and if the Russians have successfully repelled all Ukrainian offensives so far, shouldn't this mean Ukraine is now weaker than, say, a month ago? Then why should Russia now withdraw from Kherson?
Russia withdrew from Kherson because it made no sense to lose men defending a piece of territory that had no strategic value. End of story. They put men, the value of manpower over the value of dirt. Remember, Russia's got 200,000 troops showing up in the SMO sometime next month. That's 10 to 15 divisions. Why sacrifice 3,000 guys to hold a piece of turf when you can pull them back, let the Ukrainians have their moment, let Zelensky wander around like a tourist, let the little Nazi boy fly his flag and put his hand up. And then you bring in your divisions and it's just basically going to, thank you, Serge. Appreciate it. It was still inappropriate.
It's accurate, but now suddenly the story isn't as funny now that we know that.
Yeah. Well, this story should take off. But again, I think that the Russians made the right move. I mean, screw those people who think that, it's embarrassing. Really? Bury your fucking father and tell me how embarrassing that is. Bury your husband. Bury your brother. Bury your cousin. Bury somebody. Put them in the ground and then contemplate, wow, if they had just pulled them back and waited a fucking month for 200,000 guys to come in and drastically change the military balance of power, maybe I could have New Year's dinner with my loved one. But no, we had to hold on to a piece of dirt. So he died, and so did thousands of others. Stupidity in the extreme.
Okay. And Hugo from Paraguay, do you think that suicide drones, also known as Doritos, can eventually replace artillery? They're extremely cheap and accurate. I've seen some videos of them hitting moving targets.
Well, you know what's cheaper than suicide drones? Artillery. So, no, I don't think they're going to replace it. I think they can supplement artillery. But remember, for every weapon, there's a counter. Drones have guidance systems that can be jammed. They have electronics that can be jammed. They have a whole bunch of things that can be jammed. And then of course they can be upgraded, but you know, artillery is just pretty basic. It's a round. Once it fires, it's going where it's going. Ain't nothing going to stop it. So I think there will always be a role for artillery for massed fires. The drones are precision strike systems, and when they work, they work very well. But I think you're going to see that supplement and complement one another. Can they do that, Jeff? Can you supplement and complement?
Sure. There's no rule against that. That's not, they're not mutually exclusive terms.
Okay. So there you go.
All right. Okay, Tori,
supplement. I mean, it's almost four syllables.
Let's take some questions from the audience live. And while Tori's fishing around for some good questions, let me just quickly ask, Scott, is there much danger of drones being used for very nefarious and dangerous purposes aside from war, like, you know, people who want to cause trouble here domestically, you know, in the same way they might start riots and vandalize and so forth? I don't know how cheap and accessible drones are, but that's what I would be worried about.
Well, the big thing right now is what they're showing in Ukraine is both sides are using these small commercial drones, and they're putting grenades on them, and they're using them to fly over and drop the grenades with precision on enemy troops dug in trenches. And that's something that I'd be worried about.
Are they regulated tightly, or can pretty much anybody, like here in the U.S., could they?
Anybody can buy a drone. They're regulated on how you can operate them. You can't go to a certain height, and you're not supposed to. You have to have permits to use them. But the terrorists don't care. I mean, I'm a bad person. I can just take off my drone, put a grenade or two or three on them, however many, and send them out. And that's my concern right now. And also,
I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but I think of,
well, hell, I don't have to give them an idea. It's being shown on TV 24/7.
Yeah, right.
You know, then also from an intelligence collection standpoint. I mean, let's say I'm masterminding a heist of a bank. In addition to monitoring the police traffic, police understand people monitor traffic, so they have alternative means of communication. I have a drone up ahead, and I can track the police. I can call it in. I can have a live feed going to the guys watching. It's just a very effective thing. And people keep talking about government potential for abuse, but I would say that there's a big potential for criminal abuse or terrorist abuse.
Yeah. Right. All right, Tori, what do you got for us? And thanks for the support, AB. In your opinion, any chance of U.S. citizens with dual U.S.-Russian citizenship that they can be impacted in any significant way, similar to World War II, U.S.-Japanese citizens camp situation? Please consider visiting Chicago.
Well, I am visiting Chicago on Thursday, but it's done via Zoom. I'm speaking with the International Correspondents Association. But the goal is, if that goes well, and I have every reason to believe it will, then they will hopefully invite me to Chicago for a book event. And if that happens, Jeff will give it ample publication, and you should know about it, and then you should be able to come. And then I can sign a book or talk to you or buy you a beer.
I'll also help organize it. So if you, AB, are the type of person that might be able to at least be a person involved in the organizing of an event, get in touch with us and we'll work on it.
Now, to answer your question, I mean, anything's possible, especially in this day and age, but the Supreme Court has determined that what happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II is unconstitutional. So I would imagine that precedent would be brought to bear. We're not at war with Russia. So I don't see that happening. The big concern is just the prejudice that's accrued to being a Russian American today, that we've demonized Russia so much that, again, I bring it up, the Russian Samovar, a wonderful restaurant in New York City that I'll be speaking at in January, is being attacked because it uses the name the Russian Samovar. The owners are actually Ukrainian, and it's just crazy what's going on in the world today. So, but I don't think you're going to see Russian Americans being rounded up, put in concentration camps.
All right. There was a question about, do you think Trump will announce his candidacy today? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, he says he was going to. I don't know. I'm not affiliated with his campaign. There's some reason, there might be some reason for him to hesitate, given the fact that the Republican Party is starting to blame him increasingly for the midterm defeats, saying that his role and him picking candidates led to the Democrats blunting the red wave. I'm not weighing in on either side. I'm just saying that there might be a reason for Trump to hold back on announcing today, but Trump being Trump, I don't know. I think he probably will if he said he was going to. We'll see.
Can you explain the breaking news right now about the missiles landing in Poland?
My understanding is Russia's saying it's not theirs. I'd have to take a look at the fragments. What I can say is this. The Russians are pretty damn good at targeting, and I would imagine that the Russian, if I were doing this, I would ensure that the trajectory, for instance, if this is the Polish border here, Poland, Ukraine, I wouldn't fire a missile to hit a Ukrainian target that's coming in this way because, oh my God, what the, it malfunctions. Poland, I would come in this way or this way so that any error is going to keep the air inside Ukraine. Now, if I'm doing this, and let's say you have the Polish air defense systems that are firing, and they're coming and trying to track, and they mistrack, oh, Polish air defense system. So I would think that if Russia's denying this, that these might be Polish surface-to-air missiles that have flown and hit. And we've seen this before, for instance, when Syria fired SA-5 surface-to-air missiles at Israeli jets. Some of those missiles went on and impacted inside Israel. You know, that just happens when you fire a surface-to-air missile and it doesn't, it's a self-detonation feature doesn't take it, and it just goes on as like a ballistic missile. So we'll see. We got to look at the debris, and we got to see what it is.
I like your style, dude.
Thank you, cowboy.
Paul Wolf, according to Military Summary Channel, the Russians began bombing the electricity grid again after more than a week of not doing that. Is that an indication that back-channel negotiations have ended?
Well, there's never been a back-channel about peace with Ukraine. That's just an absurdity. There's been a back-channel, and there continues to be a back-channel about nuclear stability and other non-Ukraine-related stability issues. Jake Sullivan has... spoken and allowed others to speak with Russia using a variety of back channels about, you know, potential Russian use of nuclear weapons or the threat of the use of nuclear weapons, et cetera. The big player in the back channels, the guy who actually wrote a book called The Back Channel, sort of a hint, William Burns, CIA director who was recruited, not because he's a spy, he wasn't, he was a diplomat, but because he was a master of the back channel. He just met in Ankara with his Russian counterpart where they discussed nuclear stability, arms control, potential exchange of prisoners. They didn't talk about Ukraine. So I think Russia just made, I think Zelensky got up there and just ran his mouth and Russia went, okay, world, see, hot air. Let's give you some steel on target to match that hot air. And they just knocked the living dog poop out of Ukrainian infrastructure, and they're sending a signal that Zelensky's irrelevant. The only relevant thing going on in Ukraine right now is Russian firepower, and get used to it because it's just going to be that way for a while now.
Okay. Our friend Serge, we've heard from him before. He suspects that you differ from Colonel McGregor in this way. You think our leaders are responsible, and he is convinced they are irresponsible ideologues. Is Serge's suspicion correct?
Well, both can be true. You could be an irresponsible ideologue that got us stumbling into this conflict with Russia indirectly through NATO and Ukraine, but you can be responsible enough not to know that you don't want to get involved in a nuclear conflict. When I say that our leaders are responsible, I'm focusing primarily on their ability to keep us from inching towards the nuclear abyss. And I think Colonel McGregor and I are probably on the same page on that.
All right. And that's all the time we have for it. At 7:30 tonight, later today, it's our other podcast with Tori and I, The Winsome Savant. You can see her handling co-host duties, not just the abbreviated behind-the-scenes glimpses that you catch here. And Tori, what will we be talking about today?
We're talking about Dave Chappelle's monologue on SNL. So
that has generated almost as much controversy as Scott Ritter generates just by waking up every day. So tune in. And also, Tori will be in attendance this Saturday night. She's the secret big attraction, actually, not just Scott. Scott will be speaking at the Community Church of Boston on Saturday night at 6 o'clock. Go to scottritterextra.com for the details. And the rumors are true, Tori, you will be in attendance. You will be managing the book sale. Is that correct?
Yep. If you buy a book, you'll have to come through me. So
she's the muscle. She's the muscle.
All right. So Friday night, as usual, the loquacious version where Scott's answers are more expansive and at least one of us consumes adult beverages. And we started a half an hour early today, so hopefully that didn't inconvenience too many people. I imagine at least a few people weren't quite prepared for that, but sorry about that. Scott had something personal going on in his life, and that happens. Life does intrude. Anyway, see you Friday night. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Tori. And thank you so much to our beloved audience.